Hey, boys and girls, welcome to the NeoWincast News Edition for February 16th, 2007. I'm your host, Chris Vendemio. You know me as BangBang023. And joining me, as always, Mr. Rob Bright. You know him as Rob. How's it going, man?
Everything is just doing brilliantly. How's things with you?
Not bad, not bad. Just picked myself up Xbox 360, so I'm a happy geek right now.
Very nice.
Yeah, you gotta splurge every now and then, but actually, splurging is what's going to bring us right into our first topic. And Steve Jobs Steve Jobs is actually making the news again, this time for not so good reasons. There's been some stock option discrepancies, we'll say, over at Pixar Studios, where Jobs was the CEO at the time that this occurred. And basically, when he was coming up with a contract deal with a John Lasseter, he's a premier film director, he was given a stock option bonus. However, the stock that he was given, the value of the stock was backdated 3 months to when it was at a low point, so that as soon as he was given those stocks, he was in line to make a $6.4 million profit. Well, while that's legal and all, you sort of have to tell people about this. Mr. Jobs, who actually inked the contract himself, didn't let the government know, and didn't let his stockholders know. So, people are kind of upset right now. Rob, one thing that really interests me is how, for years, Microsoft was the bad guy. They did everything. They made a lot of mistakes. They did a lot of stupid things. They broke a few laws. But now it seems as though maybe the picture-perfect world over at Apple is sort of shaking to pieces a bit, maybe a few little chips here and there falling off, because, you know, Jobs is the face of that company. He resurrected Apple from going nowhere to being top of the industry. Do you think this could have a long-lasting effect on the company to the point where maybe it's detrimental to their future growth?
I think we're going to have to be very careful about sort of saying, because he hasn't been... it's not Jobs himself that is under fire here. It's Apple as a company. But because Jobs is this savior of Apple, I mean, he's basically Apple personified. That's why he's coming under fire in the media, and certainly at Neowin, there's a very long thread kind of shouting at him, basically. What's interesting is that it's not technically illegal, as you say. It's only illegal when you don't tell people about it, and this is what's happened. Okay, hypothetical situation. You know, because everyone in the past, everyone loves to support the underdog, and Apple were the underdog, and that's why they got this huge reputation, and also because of, you know, the way that they market it and such. And now that they're becoming a little bit more mainstream, you know, what happens if you know, Jobs is really implicated in this, and actually he's some sort of prosecution comes against him? I mean, what happens then? This is a completely hypothetical situation, but because of his status as the savior of Apple, is this not kind of, because it links with Apple the company, does this not mean that actually the reputation of the company will also go down? And I think, yes, it does. I think it's going to be very interesting to see exactly the results of this, because it's a pretty major deal. I mean, the public has got so used to this with kind of the Enron scandal and things like that. So to see this again in another high-profile company, it's a big deal, and I think people do care.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Enron, and that was actually the exact point I was going to make, because it seems to me that as a whole, especially in America where all this is taking place, people are getting sick and tired of the richest of the rich being greedy to a point where they're basically stealing more money from their company. Now, granted, Jobs himself didn't directly profit from this. It was a director who profited from it, Mr. John Lasseter. In the same breath, Jobs is the one basically screwing over his stockholders, because now suddenly someone's making a lot of money off of stock when, well, why doesn't any other stockholder get that benefit? Why don't they get some backdated stock so they can make instant profit as soon as they take possession of the stocks? And yeah, I mean, in the public eye, Steve Jobs is Apple. When you look back, when Microsoft was going through all their legal battles, they still are in Europe, You know, it was never directly at the face of their company, Bill Gates. It was always Microsoft as a company. So Bill Gates was the innocent guy. He was the philanthropist helping out millions around the world. Well, maybe his company needed some redirection. This is directly involving Steve Jobs, and more so than Gates with Microsoft, Steve Jobs is Apple. Simple as that. And yeah, I do think that the public is going to feel a little sick of this, and now they gave all this love to Steve Jobs, and he's coming back this way and hurting his fellow shareholders, and, well, technically breaking the law because he never reported these facts of the contract. Man, I really can't speak today. But yeah, so it's going to be an interesting story to follow. One thing, Neowin news member Hermoth, well, now he's actually a forum moderator, he actually predicted that for this year, eventually Steve Jobs would step down as CEO of Apple. Do you think that maybe he's not as far-fetched in his thinking as we once thought?
I can see it happening. It depends on the results of this, of course, but it's very major, this story. And even, I don't know, it's you know, as we say, because of the way this whole saga of Jobs at Apple, it's one of these things, you know, he was there, he started it, then he was fired, then he came back and he resurrected it from the dead. And it's this, it's almost like a religion going on with sort of Apple, people that love Apple. There's this kind of like, Steve is up right there as the kind of almighty messiah. And in a business sense, this is what he did do. He did resurrect this the company. So, I don't know, do we think he's gonna cop it for this? Somebody has to take responsibility, and it happened under his watch. Now, of course, this is Pixar, but this is Steve, and if he was implicated here, then because of reasons of integrity, I think he would probably step down as Apple, you know, in the position he's in there. So, I don't know. I think I can see it happening, and it's a scary thought, actually, because of just how integral Steve is to this whole image, this whole lifestyle, this whole religion that is Apple Computers. Sorry, Apple Corporation now. and to kind of have that come under fire is major. So I think actually Hermes was saying something quite sort of prophetic, really, and it's going to be interesting to see if this does happen. And I can see it, and I think it's going to cause huge waves in the industry if it does indeed happen.
Yeah, one thing too, I guess trying to analyze the general public, do you think that people would, you say how it, you know, it really involves Pixar, has nothing to do with Apple, but do you think that maybe, I guess I'm being my pessimistic self, regardless of what company it happens with, I don't think the public will really care or be able to discern the difference between Steve Jobs at Pixar and Steve Jobs at Apple, where in their mind, he did something, Apple is going to automatically get lumped in with him, and it's going to be one big PR, well, I won't say disaster, but one big PR problem for them. Do you think that, you know, maybe that's the way it's going to go? The public just not going to be able to separate the two?
Oh, for sure. It's only industry analysts can really kind of appreciate the difference in terms of, you know, the positions that Steve is actually in. In terms of actually him as a media personality, then this affects him personally. So actually who he works for is kind of irrelevant. Now, actually I think if this does all go down, then he's going to be forced to step down, just because his integrity and the reputation that he's built up would just be meaningless. And there'll be loads of sort of Apple fanatics that will say that with very good reason that he has actually saved the company. And I think there's a lot of truth in that statement. But that kind of mud sticks, really. And regardless of whether he was in full knowledge, it was his signature on the paper that let this happen. Now, he may not have been completely knowledgeable of the dates that this was backdated to. And frankly, I'm not an economist, and I don't understand why this thing is legal in the slightest. You know, if you do tell people about it, I just don't think backdating should be legal, personally. But that's just me from a very naive standpoint. But I think, right. Yeah, if this happens, then he's not going to be able to get out of it by saying, well, it's not Apple, because it's him as a media personality, and that's what's going to suffer.
Yeah, I mean, people do have to realize that we're not economists, as you said, so our word is only, I guess, one of the average consumer in that regard. Well, average consumers with incredibly good looks, but that's another point. But it's definitely going to be interesting to see. I'm actually anxious to see how this plays out because, well, He's a very smug character. He likes to rub it in people's faces that Apple is Apple and not Microsoft. So it'll be interesting to watch, to say the least. Yeah, he is hoping for a very entertaining year with Pixar stock options.
I mean, Apple is playing a very dangerous game with their campaign against Microsoft, or against Vista, let's say, with all this Mac versus PC adverts. And so there is this whole smugness of Apple. I'm actually slightly concerned because it's almost a smear campaign against Microsoft, and that would be illegal. But it's really, I don't know, because Apple like to think of themselves as, you know, the better company and those that don't have all the issues that that Microsoft has. So I don't know, I always was slightly uneasy by the Mac versus PC adverts, however much I think some of them are quite funny, because they've just launched in the UK with British actors as well, very, very similar to the US ones. But we've got some guys who are in a sitcom here in the UK who are doing it. And they do it great, and it looks really good. But at the same time, it's this whole feeling of smugness that I'm uneasy about. And this is kind of translated, and it's generalized onto Steve as well. And you can see that in his keynotes. So yeah, it's right him as a personality, and I think that's going to be interesting to see exactly what happens here.
But yeah, next story is, well, the never-ending battle between Blu-ray and HD-DVD just got a little bit interesting because both of them were cracked with one key. That's right. The previous incarnations of cracks, specifically for HD-DVD, required a different key for each individual movie. However, this gentleman from the Doom 9 forums, his user handle is Arnezami, has managed to crack both Blu-ray and HD-DVD using one single key. People have tested this, and, well, yeah, it works. So, right now, the AACS protection on these discs, the protection that's there to stop you from copying, is eventually somewhere down the line stop you from getting the full high-definition picture unless you're using digital wires, which can further restrict you. You know, all this restricting software that was deemed uncrackable has been cracked. Granted, Blu-ray hasn't turned on their BD-ROM Plus, which is another layer of protection to prevent people from cracking it. But, you know, the basic layers have been cracked in both formats. It's pretty huge, but I guess everyone's getting a kick out of it right now because this is another case of a company comes out, in this case both Toshiba and Sony, saying it's uncrackable, you can't crack this, this is the way it's going to go, we finally beat them. And, well, they just got beat again. So it's going to be fun to see how Sony reacts. What did you think when you first read this article, Rob?
I thought, well, you know, it hasn't been long, has it? And I guess I kind of always thought that, I don't know, whatever Toshiba wants to say and whatever Sony wants to say, the fact is nothing is uncrackable. And that is the same, it was the same for DVDs, it's been the same for every digital rights management solution ever made. That's just because however talented software developers are and engineers are at making both hardware and software solutions, there will always be a member of the community who is equally as talented who can look at ways of reverse engineering it. So I thought, you know, it was always going to happen, but I guess I am quite surprised at both the speed at which it's been done, but also the way in which it was achieved. Because basically what he's done, I say he, it might be a she, but let's assume it's a he, has managed to look at one of the applications that can play these movies, and it's a complicated thing. He's like analysed the data as it's gone through, and he's used some slightly poorly written software, he won't say which one it is, and managed to kind of reverse engineer that to get the processing key and actually use that for decryption. And it's almost like he hasn't, it's not like he's decrypted this himself, he's kind of intercepted it in a kind of man-in-the-middle attack, if you like, for security researchers and kind of intercepted it as it was being decrypted by a legal piece of software. And that's quite interesting, I think that's quite a novel way of doing it as well. Now, it was also is kind of partially linked with this story, is that last week we were talking about this with Steve Jobs and his letter to the music industry, and Macrovision have given a response.
Yeah.
And the CEO of Macrovision Corporation, their stuff is on all DVDs. This Fred Amoroso, I believe his name is, and he's been talking about how digital rights management is great and all this business and giving lots of reasons why, and we can go into that in a bit, but to have, I don't know, the whole story of DRM is in so many people's lips at the moment because it's such a topical thing. We've got this massive format battle that's going on, and now that, yep, they've both been cracked, then, I don't know, people are up in arms about it, but at the same time, it was always going to happen. It's just quite kind of amazing the way it's been done and also how quickly it's been done. So when I first read it, back to the original question, I thought, well, yep, you know, well done. Technically, you've done quite a good thing, but wow, you know, the speed at which you did it, you've got to give them kudos for that.
Yeah, and one thing, Fubar, or Fubber, I don't know how to say this guy's name, but he was actually a Neowin member. He commented on the story, and all he said was, years to come up with it, days to crack it. And it's pretty funny in a way, because these companies continue to invest millions upon millions of dollars, and they keep coming out and saying, we did it, we beat you this time, and every single time, someone out there gets the better of them. Maybe it's pure curiosity, maybe it's just to spite them, but every single time. And this guy, he even said he did it, he said it was pretty simple. He says that he made the discovery simply by watching the data as it passed through his system. That's all. All he did was sit down and watch the data, and eventually he picked up on something, and, well, one thing led to another. I'm not a programmer. I don't know the technicalities of it. But one thing led to another, and he had a crack, a working crack. And it begs the question, all the money they invested in this protection scheme, is it ever really worth it? At a point where everything seems to gonna get cracked eventually, is it really worth investing all this money into such a complicated consumer bothering protection scheme? Unlike what the guy over at MacroVision says, this doesn't increase consumer value. It does. He seems to think that DRM makes something more valuable. Someone hit him, please. You know, it's just one of those. It's one of those things that really boggle my mind, how someone can actually sit there and say that it adds value. Because if anything, it restricts us from doing anything and everything we want to it, which, well, you know, freedom would generally equate to more value. But backwards thinking, I guess, is the way to go these days in corporate America. But, Rob, do you really think it's worth it at this point for these companies to continue investing all these new protection schemes only to have them broken rather quickly?
I can understand from a business point of view why they feel the need to do it, and we've debated that hugely on this podcast and indeed within the industry. But right. you've got to question whether the fact it will get cracked, because there is so many sort of dedicated individuals out there looking to crack it. So do you think, well, yes, it's good that it prevents, you know, it prevents illegality on the part of your average consumer. Which I guess is a good thing, you know, regardless of what we think about the law, enforcing it is a necessity, otherwise it's meaningless. So I think that's an important point to note. But at the same time, you think, well, it's good that you're stopping the individual, the normal, the kind of, I don't know, John Smith of this world, from just doing it. But then you think, well, they've spent so many millions making this into a seemingly uncrackable system, and you just think, well, I can understand the reasons of doing it and the importance from a legal point of view, ensuring that your copyright is sufficiently protected such that you can actually still call it. Because you have to be seen from a legal point of view to actually do something to try and keep your copyright copyrighted, I suppose. But you have to do that from a legal point of view. So I can see the reasons for it, but you just think, well, if people are going to be that good and get rid of it, why don't they just come up with a system that's good for your average consumer? But why bother doing all this when they must have known that it was going to get cracked? I mean, anyone with half a brain who's looking at the industry can see that it would be cracked.
We're involving some Sony executives here, Rob, so half a brain might actually come into play here.
Fair, yeah, maybe I'm just kind of thinking too greatly of these people's minds, but I don't know. I just think, what are we doing? You know, we're spending this much money on something that will definitely be cracked, so why don't we just admit that it's going to get cracked and use the money for better purposes?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why they didn't just stick with CSS protection and, you know, just let it go. I mean, it's going to get cracked anyway, so why spend so much money trying to stop the inevitable when you could just use the current systems and upgrade them as you need, you know, based on the design of your product? It just seems asinine to me. But again, as well, last week, I'm tired of talking about DRM, so let's actually move to probably one of the first hardware stories we've ever had on this show, and that's actually kind of thrilling to me. But it's a hardware story that I've found oddly intriguing because I'm a geek and I constantly have to fight myself not to spend money on such a product. But I don't know if you guys remember, a few months ago, a company named Bigfoot introduced a $250 network card. For those of you who maybe don't know exactly what a network card is, you can plug that into your system, and that gets you broadband internet access, so you can get your DSL, your cable, your Fios internet from Verizon. Well, a $250 network card compared to the average of free, because it comes with your motherboard, or, you know, $15, $20 American for a standard network card, it seems as though people weren't biting. It was a great card, don't get me wrong, but people weren't biting. So the company Bigfoot has now released a lower-end network card called the Killer K1, and after rebate, it's actually retailing for $150. And, you know, before you scoff at the price, especially for some of you geeks out there, listen to some of these features. The card features a 333 megahertz version of the company's N1 network processing unit and 64 megabytes of onboard RAM. And it runs a custom version of Linux. So the whole idea of this card is to take all the network interpretation weight off your CPU and put it on the card instead, so your CPU is freed up to do whatever else you're doing, playing games, processing data, I don't know what you're doing, whatever you're doing when you're on the internet. And because it runs a custom version of Linux, you can actually install small applications onto the card itself. I believe they offer a Linux-based firewall already that you can install to the card. There was talks of BitTorrent applications and antiviruses that you could install directly on the card itself. So it would nip the internet traffic before it even got to the rest of your system. Cool idea. The $150 price tag is definitely a lot more feasible, I guess you can say, than the $250 price tag, but still, it's $150. Rob, do you think it's more geek curiosity that's going to get people to buy this, or, yeah, this is really going to... So people actually believe it's going to make a big difference in their system?
I'd never buy it. I'll say that for sure. I can appreciate some of the features, don't get me wrong. And it's an interesting kind of look at the way things work in terms of like installing applications right there at the network layer, such that it's kind of it deals with it before it even gets to your operating system. That's quite neat, and I can appreciate that from a developer point of view and just from a geek point of view. I think that's a neat feature, but I do think that for your average consumer, this will never get anywhere, and that's not who they're targeting at. But I don't know. I mean, they've got something. What do they call it? They call it lag and latency reduction technology, LLR technology. And this is supposedly great for your gaming because of the way it's taking the processing stuff off your CPU and putting it onto its own card. Then, you know, it manages to lower your ping and all the rest of it, which is great. And I'm not a gamer myself, but from knowing friends that are, and also from the Neowin, I appreciate that that's an important thing. And if you can get an extra couple of milliseconds, then who knows, maybe your frag count's going to be bigger. I don't know. I'm not a gamer. But the point is, this is only good for a very, very small niche market. It's just not good enough in terms of what it provides for the money over your, as you say, your $15-$20 card that either comes on your motherboard for free or you'd buy separately. So I think, well, yeah, maybe it's going to find an interesting home among those that are willing to upgrade their graphics cards every 5 minutes and all the rest of it. But I don't know, it's not for me, and it's not for the vast majority of users of computers. But hey, you know, they've made an interesting card. It does some cool stuff.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a cool card in and of itself, and I guess because I'm just insane in that regard, I constantly think about, well, maybe I can afford it this month. I have some extra cash lying around. But let's face it, you know, it's going for this cutback version is going for $150 American. That's 113 euros, and the pounds, I have no idea right now, British pounds, but it's expensive, and I'm just not sure that it's going to make a big enough difference. I mean, the higher end card, the one for $250, they did benchmarks on it early when it first came out and such, and they found it added maybe 2 or 3 frames per second to your average video game frame rate, which is nominal at best. I mean, let's face it, rebooting a computer, you can get a 2 or 3 frames per second variance easily, just, you know, by what's loaded into your memory, what's not loaded into your memory, and how Windows is handling things. So to even give all the credit to the card in that regard is a little meh, kumsi kumsa, you know, maybe not all that kosher. But it seems like this ultimate geek dream, you know, where we're trying to, I guess, inject steroids into every aspect of our system. And eventually, I guess you have to come down to the network card, because we've touched everything else, basically. Graphics cards, audio cards, CPUs, RAM, hard drives, they're all going crazy with all innovation. So, why not innovate the network card? But yeah, it does seem a little extremely priced for what it does. What would be an acceptable price for you, Rob? Because I look at it, I think, $75 American, maybe I'd say, all right, you got me. Here's my money, give me the damn thing. What would be acceptable to you to really give this card a serious purchase thought?
I think actually what you said about $75 US, which, hang on, I'm just trying to work it out in my head, $150 is about, well, it's about £75 actually, because we're about $2. And yeah, I think if we reduced it by half, then yeah, I think it would, because of the features, then I can see why it would be good for a lot of people that do like to pimp their system up. And hell, you know, if you're going to do this, then you've probably got a pretty nice looking system aesthetically, so we'll just shove a couple of LEDs on it and it'll look even better. It's definitely yeah. Something that is good for your LAN parties, isn't it? It's something that's good to brag about. I don't know, I just think there's so many optimizations that you can make that will give similar... so many software optimizations that you can do that will give similar kind of benefits, such that I just don't know. It's not going to find a place in my case, but I can appreciate that it's a good innovation, and that it's got some neat features. I do like the idea about intercepting traffic before it gets onto the system. I mean, we've had, you know, as you say, we've done this with just about every other card. We've got like graphics cards. You know, when AGP came out, you know, it was directly injecting it into the pipelines and stuff. And it was just the way that it worked with the CPU and the way it, you know, kind of worked with your motherboard was special, and it was different, and it was good for reducing latency and all the rest of it. So it's a natural kind of transition to bring that onto network cards. And who knows? I think if we start seeing some cool apps and some cool different applications for this Linux distribution that's on it, because it's got a, it's, I don't know, there's a, I don't know, we ought to have something like show notes for this so people can kind of have links and stuff. We'll do that anyway. So if you look at the photo of this, you can see it's actually got a USB port on the card itself, and apparently this is for you know, injecting your own applications on there. So yeah, maybe you're going to find some interesting stuff, but I just don't know, is your BitTorrent you know, download rate going to be any bigger by having it on the card than it is from having it in Windows? I don't know, but I'm not an expert in that, and I don't see quite how that works. But at the same time, I can appreciate what they've done.
Well, one thing, they're not claiming that your BitTorrent's necessarily going to be faster, but that if you're downloading something from BitTorrent while playing a video game, for instance, that it's not going to affect your frame rate nearly as much. I don't have the card in front of me. I couldn't possibly test it. But that's the whole basic idea, is just take as much burden off your CPU as possible so your CPU can be used for other, possibly more important things. Then again, guys, if you're going out to buy this card, just remember you're never going to be able to say to a chick, "Hey, baby, want to check out my network card?" So maybe you could spend your money somewhere else and get something you can brag about with a little
just
less
get a nice shirt, humiliation. You know,
yeah. Look, you can get like 3 nice shirts for $150. Come on, man. This is... So, yeah, think about it. It's a cool card. It's great to read about. I'm just not sure it's worth actually buying for yourself. And with that, we're going to jump right into the wonderful world of the Xbox 360, which I have just magically fallen in love with, even though I had to give off a considerable amount of money to get it. But people have started to complain that Microsoft's, well, let's face it, the biggest title for the Xbox right now, Halo 3, the beta testing is beginning soon, and one of the ways to get a beta invite is to buy a game that's coming out this Tuesday, February 20th, in the States at least, I don't know when it's coming out in the UK, called Crackdown. Well, some people are kind of angry, because they feel that they're being forced to buy a $60 game they may not have otherwise purchased, just to get access to the beta for Halo 3. Me, personally, I sit here reading this story, and I cannot believe people are actually upset about this. Access to a beta is not a God-given right, it's not a human right, it's not a basic right of life. It's a privilege. And why not... You know, there are 3 ways to get into this beta, by the way, so this is not the only way to get into the beta. But why not give this privilege to someone who has spent money on an Xbox 360. To me, it seems pretty logical. And by the way, it's not like you're getting a crappy game. Because, you know, I've downloaded the demo of Crackdown, and the game is pretty damn fun. It's sort of like the opposite side of Grand Theft Auto, where in Grand Theft Auto, you play this badass who's basically killing everyone just because, well, what the hell, I've got nothing else to do. This game, you're actually a cop. Well, you're basically killing everyone still, though they sort of scold you when you kill too many civilians. The guy yelled at me because I ran over a crowd of people. But, I mean, it just seems odd that people are sitting here taking their time to complain about the fact that one out of the three ways to get into the beta requires purchasing a game. Rob, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being completely asinine, 10 being 100% totally one of the most asinine things in the world, how asinine is this?
Actually, I've got to say, Chris, I kind of disagree with you.
No.
I'm sorry.
No,
I think,
come on.
Yeah,
aww.
I'm sorry. I'd love to have this united front in our podcasting sensation, but at the same time, I can appreciate where people are coming from. I think from a business point of view, it's you can kind of... It's not so far-fetched to suggest that it's a very clever marketing way of increasing sales of a game that otherwise may not have done quite so well. Now, that's not to say that it wouldn't do well. It's not to say that it's not a good game, because I'm sure it's great. It sounds pretty cool, and I had a quick research, and yeah, it looks neat. But you've got to admit that it does stink a little bit of kind of Microsoft trying to just kind of up the you know, the downloads and the payments for a game that didn't have the same fanfare as the Halo series, because it just isn't like Halo. And it's nowhere near that kind of level of media attention. So I don't know. I think yes, I can see that you know, you think it's a load of rubbish, but at the same time, I've got to say I do understand where people are coming from. I may not kind of want to write a news article about it, and I may not march right in front of Microsoft headquarters and you know, with a placard or anything like that. But I don't know. I can see their concerns. I really can see them.
Just, ladies and gentlemen, because he disagreed with me, this will be Rob's last week on the podcast. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, I don't know. Just, if you have two other ways to get into the beta program, neither of which require actually spending any money,
reason... That's irrelevant, Chris. That's absolutely irrelevant. The fact that you can get it somewhere else isn't what this is about. This is about artificially increasing the sales of a game that otherwise wouldn't have done quite so well, regardless of whether you can get into the beta another way.
But people are complaining that the fact that they feel like they're being forced to purchase a game that they otherwise wouldn't have purchased. Well, no one's forcing them to purchase the game. I mean, there are two other ways to get into this beta program, so why would people feel the need to say, well, I'm being forced to buy this game Crackdown when I don't want it? Because you're not being forced. Straight up, you're not being forced. There are two other ways to get in. I'm not exactly sure what the other two ways are. I'm pretty sure there's some sort of random selection thing where you sign up and hope to get in and such like that, but you know, I don't understand how people can sit there saying this is a bad thing, because if you look at about it, it's a bonus. People don't complain when bonus content is released on, you know, when Halo is going to come out with like three or four versions. One of them is going to cost about $90 to $100 because it's going to come in a Master Chief helmet case, you know, big whoop. People don't complain about that, so why should they complain about a benefit for buying the game Crackdown, where you get access to the eventual Halo 3 beta? I mean, yeah, it's going to inflate the numbers. Let's be honest here. A lot of people are saying you're getting a free game with the beta invite. Fine. But to sit there and complain saying you're being forced to buy a game that you probably wouldn't have purchased otherwise is kind of lame, if you ask me. It's not like you have to go out there and buy it. Even then, even if it was the only way to get a beta invite, it's not like you have to join the beta. You can just buy the freaking Halo 3 game when it comes out later this year. No?
Yeah, I agree that nobody's being forced to. And there's two arguments here. One of them is the stupid argument that's saying, you know, I've been forced to buy this game because I want a Halo 3. That's a load of rubbish. I mean, if you really want to get onto the beta, you can get onto the beta. People have, you know, when XP was in there, people, I don't know, I know I read of one case where somebody baked a cake and sent it to the Microsoft developers because they wanted to be on the beta of Windows XP. You know, you find a way to get onto, it's not difficult to get onto a beta program, it really isn't. But, you know, that aside, I think the people that are moaning about that, you know, deserve to be shot. No, no, I can't say that. I don't mean they deserve to be shot. Let's just... Okay, Neowin completely refutes any claim that Rob makes. No, okay, let's just step back a little bit from there. But I don't know, I can see that's stupid. And Chris, I agree with you entirely there. But I do think that purely from a business ethics point of view, that it is a questionably immoral way of doing things. Because as you've admitted that it is going to inflate numbers.
Oh yeah, I mean it's going to inflate the numbers, but hey, you gotta use the chips that are placed in front of you. Now, I mean, if you have this great Halo beta invite thing and you think it's gonna push a product, why the heck not? And let's make it clear too, regardless of if you buy the game or not, you still have to, there's still some sort of fee involved in getting to the beta program because you have to be an Xbox Live Gold member to get into the beta. So, yeah, I believe it to be a gold member, because you're going to be beta testing the online play, which is going to be a server stress test, so you probably have to have gold membership. So, I mean, either way, you're going to have to pay. Yeah, I mean, I don't see why people, though, feel that it's necessarily a bad thing to say that it's going to inflate sales in the game, because that's what every bonus disc, every mini game, every little extra that people throw in onto a video game or like hidden tracks on CDs are there to push sales of the album just a little more, push sales of the game just a little more. You know, how many games come with, say, a demo disc of, I don't know, like three or four little games, or it comes with videos of three or four little games, or developer commentary, because that's a big thing suddenly. You know, it's all there just to push sales of the games. Otherwise, there wouldn't be special editions, there wouldn't be gold editions, there wouldn't be all these versions of games with like an extra magazine or an extra pamphlet. It's there to sell more copies. This is their bonus disc. That's what it is in my opinion. I can understand your point, but at the same time too, it's like, who cares? You know, this is their way of making money.
I think one of the issues you raised an issue that, well, you've got bonus discs and all that jazz. Yeah, that's right, but the media kind of standing and the reputation and everything else of those mini games is indeed representative of the fact that they are mini games and not something as huge as Halo. The fact that I can see being an issue is that it's a game with little or no fanfare. Despite how good it may be, I'm not slating the game at all, but I'm saying that they're using another game, you know, this Crackdown game, and putting something which is by far inflated in media reputation and marketing buzz and all the rest of it, Halo, and then kind of putting them together, and that's what it's about. It's not about bundling a kind of a version of Tetris. It's not about that. It's about using the reputation of an unreleased game to inflate figures of Crackdown. I don't know, I can see the reason why people are pissed about it, and yes, I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to write articles about it, but I've got to stand up for the people that are moaning about it. We've got a guy called Garnet Lee. He's an editor of a video game network, and he's sort of echoing what I'm saying, that, you know, millions of people are going to buy this and they feel like they're pushed into it. Now, at the same time, as we've said before, they're not being pushed into it, but it's a very clever marketing way of inflating figures. And you can draw parallels if you like with you know, Vista Ultima Extras, because these are kind of separate things that don't really exist yet. Now, we have got Dream Scene that was just released this past week, but or a technical preview or something like that. But, you know, it's using the promise of something else in order to get you to purchase something, you know, a little bit more expensive. I don't know. There are parallels there, but at the end of the day, yes, it's clever. Yes, people aren't being forced to do it, but I can appreciate why people would feel slightly cheated and a bit kind of used by it.
You have way too much faith in people and way too much compassion, Rob. I have no...
I suck.
If you feel damn pressured to buy this game, quoting Rob over here, I'm not saying this, I'm quoting my buddy, you deserve to be shot, alright? So...
Okay, no, I'm going to ask everyone in the comments of this news, when it goes out on the front page, please write. I want you to just, you know, put one comment, put Chris or put Rob, depending on who you agree with here. Do you agree that Crackdown shouldn't be used as a kind of marketing tool of Halo, or do you believe that, yes, it's absolutely fine because it's just a bonus disc? So which of us, me or my learned friend here, which do you believe in? Just to give a... I want you to give your proper thoughts on it, but if you can't be bothered to do that, then just put a one-word comment in our news item, and I want to see lots of people listening to this and putting about here they do. I'm perfectly happy to give an apology for being a complete idiot if I'm found that the media kind of... suggestions, and everyone else thinks that yes, you're absolutely right and it's rubbish. But no, this is my standpoint, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how the Neomin community will decide.
Well, it's up to you guys now. Am I right or is Rob right? But we are going to move on to our last story. This is a rather sensitive story. In some ways, I'm going to have some cynical views on this. I know, Rob, you were saying that you have a little more personal attachment to this story, but American courts have dismissed a lawsuit against MySpace because of what turned out to be when a teenage girl who met someone who she met on MySpace in real life was sexually assaulted by that person. The article goes to read, Judge Sam Sparks of the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Texas granted MySpace's motion to dismiss the charges of negligence, fraud, and negligent misrepresentation. Basically, the family was saying that MySpace was responsible for the sexual assault that occurred because they put the two people in contact with each other. The for me at least, don't get me wrong, I feel horrible that this happened to the girl. I have no way of condoning the gentleman's activities who committed the crime. But I really don't see how MySpace was at fault here, because the girl lied and said she was 18 when she was only 13 years old, and technically not even supposed to sign up for this site unless you're at least 14 years old. And, you know, in the end, it was her choice to meet the gentleman, and obviously what happened after that wasn't exactly her choice, but it's a touchy situation, Rob. I guess, while I want to say a million and one things, I'm really curious to see what your personal experiences with stories like this, so go ahead, man.
So I should kind of point out where I am in this, because I'm slightly biased. I do some work for an international charity. It's a UK-based charity, and it's there to help promote the safe use of the internet for young people. And this is an issue that's quite kind of close to my heart, because of I've dealt with and I've been there, and I've seen the stories of people that have been seriously sexually assaulted by very, very similar to this case. And so I've been there. I'm not someone who's experienced it personally, but at the same time, I've dealt with people, and I've been involved in the production of materials to kind of prevent this. And so this is why when I was reading this before the podcast, this is why I kind of thought, yeah, I want to chime in on this. MySpace is an interesting one because it's now kind of ubiquitous in so many sort of young people's lives. It's one of those things that is used just as a kind of massive social network for just organizing your entire life, and too many people are really stupid about what they put on there. I'm not going to turn this podcast into a do's and don'ts of online social networking, because this is not what it's about. But MySpace has got a lot, and come under fire because of its lack of age verification tools and things like that. The fact is, she shouldn't have been on the service, and I believe that MySpace have a responsibility to ensure that their members aren't using this because of the very sensitive nature of the fact that people can be groomed online for sex, and that this does happen. I think in something as major as this, they do have a responsibility to ensure that their members are over 14. However, in this individual case, I do not believe that the lawsuit should have gone ahead, because, as is stated before, number one, the girl lied about her age, which is, she said she was 18, and that's a big deal. And you, online, that's just a big no-no, because of the amount of people on there that... you can't misrepresent yourself when you're dealing with things like that. You're giving out personal information. I believe it was right that this lawsuit was dismissed, and I think really it should have been kind of the parents who have responsibility here rather than MySpace to ensure that their child is using the internet safely. So yeah, I think the result of this is good, and it's right, and it's not fair for MySpace to be implicated here. But at the same time, I think it does raise an important suggestion that they need to make sure that they have age verification in place, because this happens. This is not something that you hear about. This happens. I've seen it, and I know it happens. So yeah, I will make no apology for kind of lowering the tone and making this quite serious, because it is a serious matter. But at the same time, I think it's really stupid for the parents. Yeah, and I think it's really stupid for the parents to, you know, to try and sue a big company. I just don't think it was fair. But I do think it raises some interesting stories that the industry, you know, because it's not just MySpace. We've got Bebo and we've got all the rest of them. It's important that they can see the outcome and actually, you know, make sure and do their best to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, my question, Rob, though, is because I've thought about it. Every time someone mentions age verification that they feel these kinds of sites should enforce, you know, how do they actually verify someone's age besides asking their birthday? Okay, you have adult websites which, you know, ask for a credit card or something like that, which will prove you're at least of age to have a credit card, which is generally around 18 or so like that. But how do you verify that someone's 14 and not 13? You know, where do you look for information to say yes or no, definitely, other than asking them for their birthday and hoping that they honestly answer? It just, to me, I can't wrap my mind around it, around anything that would seem plausible to actually implement in a case like this to actually verify their age.
It's hugely challenging, and I'm not, you know, I don't work for these companies, and I don't know how they should do it. I don't know, and as you say, it's one of those big challenges that it's so difficult to find a way of respecting a user's right to privacy and to have their own blog and all the rest of it. But at the same time, I think, for example, there are too many people that you know, on MySpace put their schools on there. And right, when you have people that are giving their full names and their schools and are 13, then it shouldn't be an issue, but it is an issue, because there are people out there that are looking to you know, to really take advantage of it. So it makes me wonder whether, yep, having a MySpace, you know, that shouldn't necessarily enforce some sort of age verification. But maybe if you're using some of the specific networking features, like, you know, searching for people by your school and things like that, if a school's involved, then maybe a school in the real world should actually be involved in terms of sort of making sure that this, you know, this is actually policed and the people are who they say they are. If you are saying that you're from a particular school, then I think there should be some, you know, there should be something in place to make sure that yes, that is true, and therefore that if they are going to give out that information, that they're actually doing it responsibly and not having, you know, I've seen profiles where you've had a 13-year-old girl who has had their school, they've had their full name, and they've had pictures of them in their school uniform on their blog. I mean, that's, it's crazy, and it's scary, you know. So yeah, I agree that it's a difficult, very sensitive and very challenging situation, but at the same time, I think there has to be some way of trying to kind of limit the damage that kind of sites like this can do, and promoting like the awesome kind of, they're so good for, like, you know, keeping in touch with friends and all the rest of it. I think they're awesome, but at the same time, I think there are so many issues related to the responsible use of them that even if it's not age verification, then certainly the educating of kind of young people is important to make sure that they're not exposing themselves to online dangers.
Yeah, one thing that really bothers me about this article, though, is that the fact that the parents are really blaming MySpace and not themselves for this. You know, I'm sure it would not be an easy thing to say, yeah, okay, it's my fault for. But let's face it, it's their very young daughter, 13, still a very young age, and in my opinion, they should have been there monitoring her activities, I think, a little more. I mean, how a girl that age gets to go out and meet with someone who is much older than her without, you know, any parent intervention seems a little out there for me, and it just seems to continue a trend where parents more and more care less about what their children are doing online. I guess maybe not care less, but pay attention less to what their children are doing online. And it's disturbing because, you know, every time a child gets injured or a child gets taken advantage of, are the parents going to say, it's not our fault, it's someone else's fault, and sue? You know, it just seems irresponsible, it seems immature to a degree to me, and I really wish that as a society, we can put, I don't know, just sit everyone down and say, listen, these are your children. You have to be responsible for them. I mean, I'm 23 now, but when I was growing up, I'm not that old. But when I was growing up, my parents, you know, they were involved in my life. They knew what I was doing, where I was going, and that's the way it was. Granted, I didn't have nearly as structured of an internet. I mean, I didn't even get internet at home until I was a sophomore in high school. It's my second year of high school. And it just seems like, you know, why can't more parents be like that, be involved in their children's life? I understand people, you know, they have jobs to do, they have all the responsibilities around the home, but your child is you have your child and you're supposed to be responsible for them until they're 18 years old. It's a tough topic to really, I guess, understand. It's hard to really sit down and give 10 minutes to a discussion that can go on for days at a time in an official government setting and such like that, but it's something that people really need to look at. If you're a parent, you know, check what your kid's doing. Simple as that. Again, I'm sorry this happened to the girl. At the same time, this is not MySpace's fault, so they need to get off that high horse. Now, other than that, Rob, you have anything else to add to the story?
I'd probably just say I'd echo what you just said, that it's the parents have a huge responsibility with this. And when you've got, computers going even more affordable, and for that reason that young people are being exposed to them at a much earlier age, it's important that the positive uses of the internet are encouraged, and that things like this are really kind of well dealt with in as kind of seriously as they can be. So I think parents have a huge responsibility here, and don't be so stupid as to sue a company like MySpace just because you didn't neglect your child, but you certainly didn't pay enough attention as you should have done. Now, this is all based on the news story that we've read, and we don't know the individual circumstances, and maybe there's something going on that we don't know about. But at the same time, I can't help but think that the young people should, the parental responsibility is there, and it should be encouraged, and it's important. No more kind of points to add there, other than let's just make sure that we kind of limit this as much as possible. But don't go suing people if it really isn't their fault, you know.
Yeah, it's just be responsible, be the grown ups you claim to be, and I think we could all move forward there without in placing crazy restrictions or suing every company that hosts a website that has individual profiles on it. Alright, and with that said, that's really going to be the end of the show. We've covered a variety of topics, which I'm hoping you guys enjoyed. It was definitely interesting to discuss them. But of course, we can't finish the show without our blanks of the week, so I'm going to go first this week. And my song of the week is going to be Glycerine by Bush. It's actually a song from way back in the mid-90s, 95, 96. And it's recently popped up on commercials here in America for this new album that's coming out with all rock ballads from that time period. And yeah, Glycerine is a great ballad from Bush. It's to his ex-girlfriend who broke up with him because as he got more famous and all, she just, I guess, couldn't handle it. And he named it Glycerine because apparently that's what they use in movie filming when they're trying to get an actor to cry and they can't cry on cue. Apparently the glycerine will draw out some tears. So it's definitely a great ballad. If you can, you can jump on YouTube. Everyone knows the address there. You type in Bush Glycerine, and you type in 96. You can see an amazing performance from Spring Break 96 on MTV. This is when MTV actually still had music. It was pouring rain with lightning and thunder, and Gavin Rossdale, the lead singer of Bush, went out on stage alone because his band didn't want to go perform in the obviously dangerous conditions, and he gave one hell of a performance. But yeah, check it out, Bush Glycerine. And Rob, your code of the week?
I've got a good code of the week this time. It's more an interesting technique as opposed to a tag or a particular code. What I've seen is a lot of sites, for example, right from the early days of the web, we had different link colours for links that you'd already visited, links that were active, and all the rest of it. What I've seen in some kind of websites that just have links to sort of daily sort of websites and interesting news stories or whatever, they've done an interesting technique where they've on the anchor tag, the A tag, they've put a, instead of just changing the colour, which you can do in CSS, they have added a little graphic into the background image of the anchor tag itself. And that way, you can, for example, have an image of a tick or something, and then anchor that to the right, and don't repeat it, of the background image of the link. That way, that when users click it, it won't just change colour, but it will actually have a little tick that kind of signifies that, yes, they have visited it. So it's just an interesting kind of design decision. There's different ways that you can use styling properties of links in order to achieve some interesting effects. So if you're having something like, you know, you want to inform your users, if you've got a big list of links, then, you know, consider having something like a little glyph on the side that you add with a background image. And that way you don't need to have any unnecessary JavaScript or anything of that caliber to achieve the effect, because it can be done right there in the style sheet. So a bit of a techie one, and one that will really only kind of only be useful for those that really do like to do this in a kind of hardcore way. But at the same time, I think it's interesting, and I know a lot of people kind of do listen to this and quite like it. So yep, that's my code of the week for this podcast.
I gotta give you credit, man. That's the first code of the week where I actually understood everything you were saying, because I'm terribly
awesome.
Not well versed in this. And yeah, it actually seems actually pretty interesting. I might fool around later on with my own site. But ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Before we go, though, we do have a few announcements to make. First of all, as you notice, we have intro music now, and we'll also have outro music. And I'd like to thank one of my buddies, Malcolm Flythe of 223rd Productions. They're currently working on a MySpace profile, so hopefully we can have that for you in the next few weeks. He came up with the little beat by himself in a studio. We actually have a professional intro, Rob. We're moving on up, I think, in the world.
I know, we rock. It's really cool, actually. I do want to personally thank him as well. It really works with, like, you know, exactly what the podcast's about. We've got, like, some real sort of, I don't know, electronic feel to it, but at the same time kind of rock as well. So I love it. I think it works really well. So thanks ever so much.
Also, I want to mention that the NeoWin Fantasy Baseball League that we use Yahoo for, that I just opened the league today, so you can jump in the Sports Arena forum and check out the Fantasy Sports sub-forum, and you can read all the information there. And Rob, you have information about the Skype cast with the Vanishing Point guys?
Yep, it's one of those things that was it was scheduled and then it was cancelled, and now we've rescheduled it and it's actually happening and we've finally got approval to do it. Those of you that were doing the Vanishing Point game know just how awesome it was, and how the guys behind it, 42 Entertainment, have agreed to do a Skype cast with us. I will be hosting the Skype cast with Jessica Price from Unfiction. And it's going to be really good if you want to find out some behind-the-scenes stuff on how it was all made and the challenges that they faced. So yeah, that is now happening. It is rescheduled and it is happening on Saturday. Hopefully this podcast will be posted before that happens, otherwise we're a bit screwed. And it is happening at 9 p.m. GMT or UTC. Again, check the news link. I'll try and stick it if I possibly can. I know some of you guys are getting a bit fed up with seeing that on the front page, but at the same time, a very active kind of group of our community were involved in it, and it's something that which really did go down pretty well. So yeah, hopefully you'll see it, and yeah, that's happening on Saturday.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're done here. Thank you again to everyone for listening. Thank you to Malcolm for the song. Till next week, boys and girls, have a good one.